directive, giving you more chances to win. And win big. Win big. Win big.
Hello.
Hi, can I speak with Bruce, please?
Speaking.
Bruce, this is Jonathan Mosen calling you from ACB Radio and Directive.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. A while ago, you entered the GW Micro competition, you may remember, and you won yourself a talking clock.
I certainly do.
And you also got into the draw for a copy of Window Eyes Professional. And I'm very pleased to be able to tell you that, courtesy of GW Micro, you are the winner of Window Eyes Professional.
Fantastic.
Yes, it is you.
Great.
You have won that screen reader. It's a wonderful package, works in all kinds of versions of Windows. And GW Micro is going to be sending that to you in the next little while.
Oh, thank you so much.
Congratulations to Bruce Taves of Canada, the grand winner in our Window Eyes Professional giveaway. And congratulations to all of our winners who'll be receiving their prizes in the next little while. Thanks to GW Micro, the sponsors of the Eye Opener promotion. And stay tuned, because there are even more exciting ways to win on the way.
For all the wonderful personalities and great music, what's the place to listen to?
ACBRI.
Good on ya.
Don't risk the disappointment of missing a great ACB radio program. Join our announcements list today. Receive email about upcoming programs on all our channels and new features. To join, send a blank email now to announce-subscribe at acbradio.org.
That's announce-subscribe at acbradio.org.
Or visit our website. Announcements about ACB Radio delivered to you direct and free. Just another way to stay in touch with ACB Radio.
ACBRadio.org.
Hello to you wherever in the world you are. This is Blindline, the original interactive talk show exclusively for the blind and vision impaired. My name's Jonathan Mosen, and as always, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. Well, we've got a number of things to talk about in our open forum part of the program, of course, but first, we have an interesting guest. Many people fancy themselves as being able to get on the old speaking circuit and talk about this and that and entrance audiences and hopefully even entice a reasonable fee. Well, somebody who's making a good career out of that is Wendy. Wendy's actually in Hawaii, and we were just reflecting on the fact that, you know, we're relatively close and yet we're almost 24 hours apart. At this time of the year, I think it's about 22 hours apart. So such is the marvels of the international dateline. But Wendy, thank you for joining us. Are you from Hawaii originally, or have you migrated there for the climate?
I migrated here for many reasons, and the climate is definitely the number one choice, but I'm originally from England, and I moved to the U.S. in 1983, lost my accent immediately, as you can tell, but moved over here to Hawaii 2 months ago. My husband's in the Marine Corps and is stationed over here now, and it's just been absolutely wonderful.
Now, you have lost your accent. Is that a deliberate choice that you made to kind of blend in?
No, it was not a deliberate choice. It was just at 12 years old, the Albania accent, which is where I first landed when I got to the U.S. And from time to time, you can hear some quirky English sounds come out of me, but I'm pretty American now.
Yeah, maybe it's like a Massachusetts accent, because I've always thought some Massachusetts accents sound quite British in some ways.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
And we love your accent, too.
Oh, that's very nice. Hey, what was it that brought your family over to the U.S.? Because that's quite a big thing to do. It's a very different culture between the English and American.
Absolutely. And my dad is American, my mother English, and my dad, actually, when he was a teenager, moved over to England with his family, who were military family, and he stayed there for, well, most of his teen and young adult years, and met my mother, and they thought, well, 83, they made it happen, and stayed here ever since, and we love it. Definitely a different culture, different speed. Do things in this country quite a bit faster and, I guess, more stressful than what I was used to in England. But then again, I was only 12, so what stress do you have at 12?
Well, yeah. You know, one country tends to look down on the other a little bit, don't they? I mean, the English have this view. I'm being very generalist here, as one must be in this sort of comparison, but the English tend to have this view that that the Americans are a bit crass, and the Americans seem to think that the English are quaint but a bit behind the times. So how do you stride that kind of cultural divide?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you talk about that. culture, because here, even in Hawaii, I'm having a big culture clash as well from the mainland. When I first moved to the U.S. from England, I found that the Americans did appear to be that stereotypical, loud, and, you know, very upfront, very candid with their opinions. But I was like that myself in England, and so I absolutely ate this up. I loved it. I loved the environment. I was injured in a car accident in 1988, and due to illness in the family over in England, I went back, now, of course, in a wheelchair. So I saw the country a lot differently than when I did as a walking woman. And I found in England that their ideas about things are so different, and specifically with disability, they looked at me like I was just not necessarily a freak, but very unique. Like, how possibly could she be in England by herself in a wheelchair? How come she's not in a home? And then, jumping ahead now to coming to Hawaii 2 months ago, this state is so accessible, but they don't know why they are. They do it because legislation has told them to do so, but they can't figure out why they have to, because there aren't many people in their minds walking around with a disability or rolling around or using a guide dog or whatever the disability may be. We're not seeing these people in the community. And so I was a real unique item, so to speak, here in my town of Kailua in Hawaii, because I'm a mother of three children as well. So to go out in my van and my Lyft and have all three kids come barreling out of it, it was definitely something that hadn't been seen before.
Okay, and so you were what, fully able-bodied before you had that accident?
Yes. And I was injured, like I said, 1988 as a 16-year-old. I fell out of a car at 90 miles an hour, fell out through the sunroof, and smashed my back on the curb upon landing, and have, of course, used a wheelchair ever since.
And so how does one become a motivational speaker? I mean, I suppose one doesn't just grow up and decide that's what I'm going to do, because you'd expect one needs a bit of life experience to do that.
Absolutely. And I was just talking to a colleague of mine about this subject, is that what is it that makes a motivational speaker? And it really is, what message do you have that you can bring to your audience? What unique message can be delivered? And I have found that, you know, I've been on the speaking circuit for 12 years, and so I've seen all types of speakers with all types of subjects, all types of genres, and just all types of unique messages, and some classic messages. And I've seen quite a few, quote, disability-related topics, and coming from disability speakers, and I'm using that term just as kind of a general term at the moment. When you have a disability and you hear about the fees that you could make on the speaking circuit, a lot of people with disabilities assume that, well, because this has happened to me or because I have this disability, I can go be a speaker as well. But I have found in my speeches that in order to reach the audience, they don't want to hear about just triumphing over adversity. They want something that they can relate to. They want something out of your character that totally makes sense. And for the first, I would say, 6 years of my speaking career, I primarily talked about disability and disability-related subject matters, accessibility or architectural accessibility, disability awareness. And I found that at that time, which was around the time that the ADA legislation passed, that was okay. That was sort of the topic of the moment. But now that that has passed, I thought, you know, I need something other than just my disability to carry me through the speaking circuit now. And you have to have these little life experiences that you can tie together and think, what have I learned from these experiences that I can pass on to somebody else? And lots of us go to seminars voluntarily, and lots of us are forced to go through our employers setting up big seminars. And the ones that we are going to voluntarily, our inner self is saying, I'm looking to learn something. I want to achieve something new. these are the great audiences where you can just pass on that unique message that you have to offer, that unique little tidbit of something that you have learned from, whether it's humor, whether it's something adverse, whether it's something traumatic, that an audience can say, you know what, it's a different experience that I had, but the emotions that she felt were the same as mine, and boy, that really has helped me. So I think many people have a story to tell, and many people have stories that are marketable. The question is, who is your audience? So instead of saying, I want to get out on the speaking circuit because I have a great story to tell, go the other way and say, okay, who would my audience be if I told this story? Then you can clearly define if your story is worth getting out there on the speaking circuit. Because if your audience is only one or two people, it might be something that you can broaden to then take out onto the speaking circuit.
I suppose there would be some disabled people who frown on this whole practice altogether, the whole super crip syndrome.
Well, I am one of those people. I don't believe that I'm interesting because I have a disability. I believe I'm interesting because I'm Wendy Jones, and that has to be your focus when you're out there as a speaker that happens to have a disability, because the audience has grown tired of the super crit message as well. It is not, it just isn't a unique topic anymore to go out there and say, I've overcome this, or I've overcome that, or, you know, this happened to me, and, you know, look at what I've faced, and look at what I've learned from it. They want humor. They want motivation. They want something other than, well, I'm disabled, and, you know, this is what I did to be normal again. They're done with that. They're done with that.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose you'd be working hard not to leave people with the impression that, gosh, if she can do all these things and she's in a wheelchair, then what am I complaining about? And often that's the kind of message that you hear that people are left with when they are presented to by speakers who have a disability.
You're absolutely right. And that's always my measure of success. If the feedback at the end of a speech or a seminar is, wow, you know, you are so inspirational, then I know I've done something wrong. But if they're coming up to me and they're saying, wow, you really inspired me to do such and such differently, then that's the measure of success for me that I need, because there's a lot, just a complete difference in someone putting their hand on you saying, you are so inspirational, compared to, wow, you have really inspired me to do this differently in my life. I think sometimes that people with disabilities don't like to be called inspirational. We don't like to necessarily be that role model of triumph over tragedy. But it is okay to be inspirational and be disabled and to be able to separate the two. I used to have a really hard time with people coming up to me saying, boy, you're really inspirational, or you're really inspiring me. Then I started to see that, you know what, there are probably some things in my message that people are getting that is inspiring them to do things differently in their life. That is a lot different than the pity message of, oh, you're so inspirational, you know, and patting me on the head while they're saying it. So you have to tend to look at that as your measure of getting your message across. Is it out of pity that these people are coming to you saying, that's a great presentation, or is, wow, that was a great presentation, really lifting them off their feet for the right reason?
So it could be the difference between giving people the warm fuzzies and thinking, you know, aren't you disabled people marvelous, versus clearly understanding that you've said something that they can translate to their own lives for the better.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I have found that my market, because I am a mother of three children, because I am in a great marriage, I have a good family structure, I'm finding that that is relating a lot to the audiences. And the disability is very back burner, but yet at the same time, they do say, you know, that I should say they are still looking at the disability thinking, wow, you know, she is a mother of three children and she does have a disability. I think that that's always there, but it's never the main focus anymore. And I don't think there's anything wrong with it per se to think that, well, you know, that's pretty neat that, you know, that woman is out there and she's doing things normally and she's a mother of three young children and she's in a wheelchair. I don't think that that's bad to think that, but then to add the words, boy, and she's just courageous doing it. There's nothing courageous about changing diapers. You know, diapers smell if you're in a wheelchair or not. So it's finding the humor in the experiences that I'm finding is reaching to the audience and using the disability sort of as my way in the door, but also at the same time back burner information. And, you know, I feel that if I am out there on the speaking circuit, and if I obviously have a disability that people can see, then I feel that it's also my responsibility to be educational and to not disregard my disability and not answer questions about it. And I actually had a man come over to me the other day, and he just thought that I was the greatest thing because I was in a wheelchair and I was wheeling around, and that was just fantastic. And he put his hands on my head, and he asked me if I knew the Lord. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, where are we going from here? I mean, I just thought he was going to try and pull me out of my wheelchair and heal me right there on the spot. But I thought that, you know, I can sit back for a moment and I can let him have his moment of feeling that perhaps he's doing something Good Samaritan, his big Good Samaritan effort. Perhaps it's making him feel good. And that's also something to remember, because in my first several years of being disabled and being on the speaking circuit and trying to deny the fact that perhaps I had a message to tell that might be disability related, I didn't want to talk about my disability, and I got very offended when people wanted to talk about it because I wanted them to focus on me. But I found that when you're in this position, sometimes it's best, and I'm not saying necessarily to keep your mouth shut, but to let people have their moment. If it's helping them, fine. But there's also those moments where the opportunity for education arises as well. And this, perhaps, with the man laying his hands on me trying to heal me, wasn't necessarily a time for me to educate him, but a time for him to feel that maybe he was doing something good in the world. And it's just one of those things that you just have to decide every, you know, circumstance you have. Is this a time to educate, or is this somebody that's ignorant that might not absorb the message anyway?
Well, what do you say? I suppose it depends on your own personal religious value set. But
I've come across different situations religiously where people have said, you know, if you have more faith, then, you know, maybe you'd be out of your wheelchair. If you come to my church, I can guarantee you, you'll be up out of that thing. And I think it's just humorous. I think it's humorous because I feel that I was given not necessarily a second chance, but a second, or not even a, I don't want to say it second because it kind of implies that my first time around wasn't great, but just an opportunity to live life with a different perspective. I had a near-death experience that sometimes I talk about in my seminars and sometimes I don't, depending on the audience. But I had an experience that alerted me that there is spirituality in the world, and I have a to-do list, and part of my to-do list is to educate people, about who I am and what I have to offer to the world and what we have to offer each other to the world. And the people that are coming to me saying, well, if you had more faith, you'd be walking, I laugh on the inside because it was my faith that has enabled me to be back in the world as somebody in a wheelchair, to be able to live life differently and experience life just in this fantastic way. And people can't understand how my life can be fantastic because I use a wheelchair, but I think of my opportunities and my experiences that I've had and the people that I've met and the friends that I have that have all come about because of my disability, and I would never trade it for a million years. And you have people out there, specifically like Christopher Reeve, who is promoting the cure for him, basically that they'll donate money to spinal cord research to get him up out of his chair. And to be quite honest with you, I am one person that doesn't donate to spinal cord injury research as a cure to get myself out of the chair because I feel this is a gift, and I'm utilizing my gift. So these religious experiences, you know, sometimes I educate and I let people know that I am here for a reason and I'm in this wheelchair for a reason, and here's my agenda. And other times I let people have their moment, and I sometimes, you know, I feel that it's, you know, they're judging me and I don't want to judge back, and I sometimes keep my mouth shut.
But then don't they get disappointed if they try and do the healing trick and it doesn't work?
Absolutely. So I think, well, should I flail myself out of the chair and let them believe they've actually risen me up from my burden? But the healing's on the inside. You know, we can be walking around but be very disabled on the inside and be putting all of these self-imposed barriers on ourselves, and that's true disability. Disability to me is not being blind, is not being physically disabled, is not having a hearing impairment. Being disabled is going through life with this stereotypical perception of how the world should be, or how people should act, or how people should look. Those are the people with the true disabilities, because they're living a life with complete tunnel vision and missing so many great people and so many great opportunities. And you know, I try to tell people that as much as I can, but, you know, to some people that just won't absorb it, they look at me and think, oh, well, wheelchair, you're going to be living your life very bitterly. So, you know, sort of sometimes it's a lose-lose situation.
What would you do, though, if somebody came along tomorrow and said, we have a 100% certain cure that would see you up and about again without the need for a wheelchair? Would you take it or would you not take it?
Well, it's interesting because I've thought about that many, many times. And if somebody came to me and said, you know, we have this cure and you'll be walking a little bit differently than, quote, normal, but you'll be up out of your wheelchair, then I would question it, because I'd ask, well, you know, could I get around as fast as I can in my wheelchair? Because I've been in a wheelchair now for almost 15 years, and I was injured at 16. So almost half of my life now has been in the wheelchair. And as adult, as a mother, as a wife, and as a business person. So I don't know things any differently, really, than using my wheelchair in this big, big world of ours. And so it would be very scary to give this up and to say, yes, I'll now go through life walking. And I really don't see it making much difference either way. I think that walking or rolling, that I think my journey will still be established. My to-do list will still take place. But it's something that I've waffled about, and I really don't know the answer. I think I'd definitely be in line for the cure if it meant that I'd be up out of my wheelchair, walking and running the same way I did before my injury with the knowledge that I have now. I think I'd do it.
Okay.
But then would have to be conditions. So I think as long as I'm putting conditions on it, I'll probably end up staying in my wheelchair and being quite comfortable.
So how does one get on the speaking circuit? How did you start getting the engagements?
Well, I started by accident. At 18 years old, I was offered the opportunity to become the spinal cord injury prevention spokesperson in Florida, and started getting in front of audiences that way, and that's how it branched out and really blossomed for me, was starting that way. But what I am telling startup speakers is the best thing to do is really sit down and write some things that have happened in your life, humorous, because it's humor really that is selling on the speaking circuit, and think about the thing. You start formulating a speech, and you start very simply by going out to your chambers of commerce, your Lions Club, your Rotarians, your Kiwanis, and you start doing as many free speeches as you possibly can, because that will establish your name in your local area. Once you have your name established and you make your make a newspaper reporter your best friend, and invite your newspaper reporter or anybody that will come to your speaking engagements at all of these different facilities, but you're not going to get the big bucks right out of the chute. You have to start off doing them for free. And then when people start hearing about you regionally, you start charging travel expenses and you start charging a small honorarium. Once you start building your circle and your circle is widening, you then start getting involved with a speaker bureau and getting a situation, because some speakers don't like working with bureaus because bureaus do take 25% of your fee and they also take a little bit of control of where you speak, compared to not working with a bureau where you can change and evolve your material anytime you want to, and you can change your fee anytime you want to, and you pay yourself the entire fee. So there are pluses and minuses to working for yourself or working for a bureau, but once you start getting at least 50 to 75 free speeches, you are definitely getting a name in your local area to the point where you can start doing special occasion speeches. Say, for instance, you've done your Rotarians and they're having their big annual Christmas dinner and they've asked you to come speak for them. It's okay to go back to them after you've established your name and my fee is this and I do have travel expenses. Once you've established the name with any of these groups, they're more than happy to pay an honorarium and travel expenses. And once you start having a couple of those under your hat, that's when you can start charging the big speaker fees. And once you get at least 10 speaking engagements, 10 to 15 speaking engagements at approximately $1,500 to $2,000 a piece, you can start going to speaker bureaus and saying, here's what I'm earning. I'm definitely lucrative for your bureau. Can you get me out there and market me? And sometimes they take you, and sometimes they'll say, well, go do another 10 more at $2,500, and then I'll take you.
You know, some people feel a bit reluctant to charge, don't they? They know they're good, but especially if it's a smallish community and they enjoy it, they feel a bit reluctant about having the courage to go up to someone and saying, look, this is what I am charging now.
You have to be an incredible self-promoter when you are a professional speaker. You have to know that when you set your fee at $2,500 or $3,500, I mean, these fees go up to $75,000, $100,000 per speech. I mean, the sky is the limit. You have to know that you are worth it. You cannot get on the phone and say, well, my fee is, you know, $2,500, and not be confident and not back it, because they'll know it and they'll pay you for what they feel you're worth. You should always be in charge of your self-worth, including your fee, and confidently stand behind what your fee is, and you make your prospective buyers absolutely believe and confidently feel that they are purchasing a speaker and know that they will get their money's worth for it. And that's the thing too, if you are very skeptical about your message and you're not quite sure how it's going to work, that's how you get the practice. You go out there, you offer your services for free, you get practice, you learn the speaking style and skill that you want to use, that how you want your voice to sound, what dramatic gestures you want to use, what music, what lighting, what clothing colors. I mean, every single element is important when you're on stage and charging the professional speaker fees, because when you're up there charging $3,500, you have to have it all together from head to toe, from the way you look to the way you sound to what your message is giving to the audience. And you can't get up there and charge $3,500 if you're still waffling around on what your overall message is.
Is it appropriate to charge based on the type of engagement or not? I ask because I've been in situations where I've been recruiting speakers for small organizations, and you ask someone pretty significant and they write back and they say, well, my fee is this, and it's way out of the ballpark that these small organizations are looking at. And you sort of think, gee, that's a bit unreasonable. They should take into account the kind of organization we are. What's your view on that?
Well, I am one of the, I think, few speakers, to be honest with you, that bends the rules. I feel that I'm in the speaking business to deliver a particular message, not necessarily make $1 million. And I am willing to, I have done a lot of free speeches well beyond the, you know, 75 to 100 that some speakers start out with. I have done well beyond that. I have worked well under my fee. I have worked in situations where just travel expenses, because it's important to me to get the message to the audiences. If a speaker is not willing to come down in fee or negotiate to perhaps, there's a bartering that needs to go on between a speaker and an organization, and if that bartering doesn't take place with the speaker, then I can positively guarantee you that you would be disappointed if you did get all the money together and pay that speaker, because the message would be very general. It wouldn't be specific to your audience. You would feel that you have just paid, say, $5,000 for a speaker that has given the same speech 1,000 times over and hasn't personalized it for your audience. That's what you get from a speaker that doesn't think, okay, well, what can we do here to make this work? Those are your best speakers.
Mm. And that is true. Yeah, there are some speakers that once you've heard them once, you've heard their entire repertoire.
Absolutely.
All right. Now, what about the components of a good speech? Now, you mentioned humor earlier, and humor's a very powerful tool, but it's also potentially fraught with danger, isn't it?
Yes, because there's that fine line of how much humor can you use to be taken seriously? What type of humor can you use that will, A, get your point across and be absorbed? I have found that if you have... what you always want to start with in a speech, not necessarily a joke, but you want to start with something that relaxes the audience, brings the audience to you. Nothing is funnier, to be honest with you, than a speaker walking up on stage, or in my case, rolling up on stage, and tripping or falling over, and then laughing at it. It's showing the audience that, my God, they're human. They're not, you know, this absolutely 100% perfect motivational speaker that's going to make me feel like I'm not accomplishing anything in my life. People like to relate to somebody that can make fun of themselves, that can pull somebody out of the audience and say, you know what, you're sleeping. You know, wake up, I'm much more exciting than what you're implying. People that are off the cuff with the humor, not... the stage jokes, or hey, have you heard that one about blah blah blah? People aren't in the mood for that, and people definitely don't like political jokes, racial jokes, stereotyping jokes. They like things that have happened to you that are funny. They want to laugh at you, because what it does, it reminds them of something that's happened to them that may have been equally as embarrassing, that they can sit there and go, yeah, that's happened to me too, that's hilarious. That's the humor that I'm talking about, not the let's go on the internet and find some really good...
Those things are so audience-specific, and if you
Absolutely.
Choose the wrong audience, you're in...
And you were talking about components of the speaker or speech. That is the absolute top priority as a speaker that you have to take, is knowing your audience. You can't go into a situation where... You know, I have four different speeches that I use, and some become seminars depending on the audience and depending on the time frame. Those speeches are never the same, ever. You have to know your audience, because if you can't win them over in the first 30 seconds that you step out on stage, you have lost them for the entire time that you were there. That first 30 seconds is going to make or break you, literally. And what I have learned in my speeches is that it's real first. If you stall for too long and you start to see people shifting in their seats, you've lost it again. And it's difficult in the middle of a speech to gain the audience back again. So you have to hook them in the beginning, and 30 seconds later you got to hook them again, and you got to keep hooking them with something new, something off the cuff, something unique, something fantastic, or something that's making them hold their bellies because they're laughing so hard.
Yeah, and delivery's obviously critical, isn't it? It's sometimes you can hear somebody who has some brilliant material, but their delivery is atrocious, and they're just missing out on the potential of that material.
And that is absolutely right. I have a friend of mine is also a speaker, and we have sat and listen to speakers that the content is fantastic, but they are absolute. And it's so important to, I will say a lot of the time that comes from, it's one of the speeches that they have robotically done so many times that they are forgetting that there needs to be that inflection in the voice, and there needs to be that audience interaction, and there needs to be that kind of touch on the shoulder of somebody in your audience as you're walking past them, or reaching out with your hand, or using the microphone some way or another. And we have thought to ourselves when we've listened to people that, boy, you know, their material is so good, but the speaker themselves seem almost bored with their material because it's been done so many times. And it's keeping it fresh. You constantly have to look at your material and think, what can I do to change this just a little bit? Just keep running on it. Again, you've lost them. And unfortunately, this great, big, fantastic speech that you've put together isn't going to be absorbed by anybody. And if you have products to sell at the end of your speech, you can forget about selling anything because, I mean, why would they want to be bored that with a tape that you have to sell if you bore them, you know, in person?
I suppose everybody has their off days, though, don't they? And there will be times when, no matter how good a performer you are, you feel like you're really going through the motions. You just don't want to be there.
You're absolutely right, because I myself have had off days, and I have said to my audience, you have to... It definitely depends on the situation, because when you're in a seminar, sometimes you're in a smaller group and you can be a little bit more one-on-one with your audience. And I have said to my audience, you know, I'm sorry, I'm a little stressed today. I, you know, had this type of a day, or I don't feel on day, audience. And it has really taken the edge off for me. It's taken off that tension of, you know, that 30 minutes prior where you're warming up and you're getting ready to go on and you just feel like your day has just been the worst ever. And you can't psych yourself up for the performance, which nevertheless makes you even more stressed out. And when I've kind of come into the seminar and said to the audience, look, you know, I've just sort of had a bad day, bear with me for a second, audience, you know, and they do, and they like that human aspect of the speech. They feel, I've heard this from my audience, they feel privileged that, you know, I am telling them, you know, I've had a bad day, because they believe that motivational speakers can never have a bad day, and they're always on top of their game. It's much better to admit to your audience you're having a bad day than come off like you've had a bad day. It's what I'm confusing is, admit it rather than having such a poor delivery because you've had a bad day, and leave them with the impression of, boy, I heard she was a great speaker, or he was a great speaker, and boy, did they come off like they were having a bad day. I don't think I'll ever go back and hear them again.
You mentioned the warming up process. How do you psych yourself up for a big speech?
You know, everybody tells me that a great speaker is somebody that still has the butterflies every time they go out on stage. And that's reminding you that you're not better than anybody that you're talking to. That's reminding you that you just happen to be lucky enough to be up there delivering a message that tomorrow somebody else could be telling as well. And it's a humbling process as well. I don't know if you've how many speeches or seminars you've been to of well-known speakers, but sometimes speakers can come across as though they are the absolute rock star of the speaker's world.
Yeah.
And I don't buy it. I don't buy it. And I don't think just a simple, almost sounds a little bit cheesy, I don't believe anybody's better than anybody else in any market, specifically the speaker's market. And I find that most of your top name speakers, some don't warm up. They don't take the time to relax and get on stage and familiarize yourself with the audience, and they come across that way. And I think that the most precious time that you have, that 30 minutes prior to your speech that they're typically doing announcements, or maybe they're giving out awards, or maybe there's another speaker ahead of you, sit with the audience, talk with some of the audience, use some of the audience to help you. You know, you pull someone out of the audience and say, look, you know, I usually have a timekeeper for my speech. Do you mind standing in the back of the room and listening to my speech? And, you know, at 15 minutes, can you give me some type of hand signal? Audience members love that. They feel that's just the best thing, to be involved with this big professional speaker. Or perhaps you've the person that's going to introduce you hasn't looked over your introduction, and you take the time, hey, let's go over my introduction. You hand them your introduction. You give it as a gift. You say, here's my introduction. Let's go over this. I want to make sure you can read my handwriting, or make sure that you can read what I've typed here. It's showing you're human, and what it's doing for you on the inside is getting in touch with the audience, knowing that there are people out there that are going to be paying money to listen to you in 30 minutes or less. And it is reminding you that you're no better than them, and that when you get up on stage, if you make a mistake, it's okay. Breathing, it slows your breathing down. It's getting you talking, because if you're sitting there waiting to go on and you have 30 minutes to kill in silence, the only thing you're thinking about is, oh, my goodness, I'm going to fall off that stage, or what if the microphone pokes me in the eye when I go up there? What if I start choking? And you start stressing yourself out, and you start getting anxious, and your breathing starts getting raised, and you feel that heart thumping inside of you, and you think, oh, my goodness, can people hear me breathing this loud? And you can't deliver that first sentence with that power that you need. So I find by talking to the audience, talking to the announcers, it slows the breathing down. It gets the voice down to the pitch that it needs to be. It kills the time so that you don't have too much time to think about anything else but just getting up there and delivering a phenomenal speech.
It's very interesting to hear you say that, because I've found even through all of my radio career that there are very few shows where, before going on the air, I haven't felt a particular sort of pang of nerves, and people find that remarkable. But I think that most good broadcasters will go through that just as
Absolutely.
Speakers do.
Absolutely. It's just that reminder, like I said, it's that I don't have all the answers, but the answers that I do have, I'll deliver them and hope they connect with people. I'm open to criticism as much as I'm open to praise, and, you know, here goes. Let's see what happens. And I just think it's a great process to go through, is just to remind yourself, you know, I'm not the best at this, but I will go up there and deliver the best possible presentation that I can, and hope for the best, and know that I will do my absolute best possible job.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with Wendy Jones on Blind Line, and if you'd like to give us a call, by the way, the number here is area code 212-812-2800. That's New York in the US, 212-812-2800. And then when Spiderphone asks you for a conference code, the one to enter is 0480-5512. And when the calls come through, we'll get to them as quickly as we can, 0480-5512, and you'll be able to find the title bar contains that information if you're using Real Player or Winamp version 2. If you're using Winamp version 3, good luck. Now, the whole issue of motivational speakers getting together has always interested me. What happens if you have do motivational speakers have a conference, a get-together, where they all try and motivate one another?
Could you imagine that? It would just be a total freak-out conference.
Would it be a hoot, yeah.
So high on everybody just... you know, getting us to our maximum potential. But no, there are speakers conventions that invite people, invite speakers from all different types of topics, all different types of fields, from, you know, business to the motivational, everything in between. I typically have not gone to a lot of those conferences because, a couple of reasons. One being is that I am so determined to stay as unique as I possibly can and to do basically what my body, myself, my subconscious is telling me to do on the platform. I'm finding that these days, and I don't want to come down on the speaking profession, but speakers conferences have lots of speakers that are selling products to other speakers. And quite honestly, other speakers are not my audience. I don't want to market products to new speakers. I want them to learn the ropes as I have. I don't getting going in profession. And you always, I think, start out with a little bit of money, and that little bit of money runs out to no money, and then maybe you get a big check from one big speaking engagement, and that runs out again. And it's hard to get the information from other speakers these days about the best route to take or the best way to go get into the speaking business without paying for it. Lots of speakers are charging for their information. So instead of their audience being the general public with this great unique message, what they've decided to do is take their speaker knowledge and market to other speakers. That's fine, but that's not for me, and that's what happens in speaker conferences, because I think then what you're doing is sort of like preaching to the choir. You're basically not helping anybody, I guess, lower down the chain in the speaker business. You're profiting from them, and I don't want to profit from somebody that might have a better message than me. I want to help them get out there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Now, organizations like Toastmasters, for example, do you think they're helpful for people who have ambitions in the speaking area?
They're very, very helpful. They're definitely the first place to go. If you feel that you have a story to tell, or if people have told you that you have a great voice and you should get into the speaker business, Toastmasters is definitely a place to be. They test you on all types of things, from your timing to those that we always seem to have in our speeches, no matter how many times you go to Toastmasters. At least I do. But they teach you things that you can avoid in delivering a speech, taking out the ums, the ahs, the pauses that you need to put in, just really good technical information that you need. But it's also good, too, to have a speech coach. You can find them anywhere. Speaker organizations have them listed. They're all over the Internet. I am lucky enough to have one that's also a friend of mine, so she tells me exactly what I need to hear. And it has worked out very, very well, having a speech coach and having someone listen to the speeches and listen to my tapes to be able to tell me, you know what, that wasn't as fantastic of a speech as you thought. Here's what you need to work on. You need that. And that's the one thing that I have found that up-and-coming speakers are not aware of and aren't prepared for in the speaker business, which is criticism. You have to have a strong backbone to be in the speaker business because, let's face it, one, you're in front of audiences that not everybody is going to appreciate this fantastic story you have to tell, and there are going to be people in your audience that want to pick apart what you have just said to make you look bad. That's a given. There's always one in an audience. Second is you're going to receive feedback forms. A good speaker always has a feedback form so that you know what points were good, what points touched the audience, and what points meant absolutely nothing. And you have to be able to take the criticism that comes from feedback forms. And sometimes that's a little difficult, especially when you feel like you've given the most fantastic speech of your entire life and you're getting feedback forms that say otherwise. The third is you have to listen to tapes of yourself, and you have to give them to other people, and you have to tell these people, friends, neighbors, family, speech coaches, professionals, whoever it may be, listen to the speech and please tell me where I may have messed up. You have to be willing to improve on your speech every single time you deliver a speech. You have to get better every single time. You are never perfect, even after... I think he's been speaking now for 15 years, maybe even more than that. Anthony Robbins always says, now he's one of the ultimate personal achievement experts and motivational speakers, that you are never going to be perfect on the platform. You're always going to find things to improve on. And that's okay, because eventually you'll see, boy, look at where I started and look at where I am now and look at where I could be. And so that you have to be prepared for. And you always have to be prepared for somebody in the audience, a heckler or somebody that thinks that you are the worst thing that they have ever come across in your entire life. Even though they may never be in your audience, you always have to be prepared for that, because there's always somebody out there that wants to basically rain on your parade. And they sometimes show up in seminars, so be ready for criticism. And it's hard for speakers because they're so used to, typically they're getting into the speaker business because so many people have told them, oh, you're so great, you got to tell the story, or oh, you speak so well, you've got to tell your story. They get in the speaker business and they're told by unlimited amounts of people that, wow, your message isn't that great. And it's hard, and a lot of people come and go in the speaking business for that reason.
All right, let's go to Denver, Colorado, and say good evening to you.
Hello. This is Janine Stanley, and get out your umbrella, Wendy. I'm here to rain on the parade.
This is my speech coach, everybody.
Oh, really?
She's been drenched more times than no. Actually, she hasn't. We've taught each other a lot, especially about the business, and that's what I'm going to go into, Wendy.
Thank you.
So we're all blind out here. How are we going to relate to this sighted audience? I heard you mention music and stuff before. Oh, my God, do we have to have music? Do we have to? What are we going to do? How do we do this? I'm going to hang up and let you go on with this so other people can talk to you. But
so that I'm not able to taunt you back, huh?
Well, exactly.
No,
okay. I know better.
You stay right there, Janine, and take it.
Uh-oh.
Take what's coming to you.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
You have to take it.
It's like the little kids where I'm going to smack you in the face, but I'm going to run away so you can't smack me back. We both know how important it is to have multimedia and multi-sensory components to a presentation. Whether you're blind or hearing impaired or have a physical disability, you have to offer all different sensory components to a presentation. You have to have music, somewhat, depending on the seminar, depending on the speech. You have to have that great message. You have to have visuals. And then we're talking here, as Janine said, now, okay, if I'm blind and I'm going up on stage, I mean, do I have to put together visuals? Do I have to put together music? You do. You really do, because nothing is worse, whether you're blind or not, than somebody standing up or sitting on stage with nothing else but the message. And some people will argue that and say, yes, but it's just my message that's important. I don't want to distract them from the message. But if you have been to a seminar or been to a speech where there is no other aspect, no music, where there's no slides, where there's nothing else but just speech, I can guarantee you that 99% of the time you are bored after the first 5 minutes because you're looking and thinking, oh my goodness, please move around or do something. If you don't have those other elements in your presentation, if it is biology major, I'm not anything to do with the brain, but if you don't have those other elements, you seem forced in one position. You don't move around on stage and people are looking at a statue and they bore and they don't listen anymore. So blind or not, yes, you have to have music, and yes, you have to have slides. You have to give people a picture of your message, and you have to give people sound to relate to your message. And just as an example, because if people are saying, well, what kind of music relates to my message? I have a seminar where I teach a lot about stereotypes and labeling, and I have an exercise where visuals come up on the screen of different types of people, white man, black man, or Asian woman and a young child, and they have to tell me, you know, what's coming up on screen. And I have music underlined, and it's Aretha Franklin's Respect. So the whole time they're going through the stereotyping exercise, you have this Aretha Franklin Give Me Respect message going on underneath. You'll be surprised at how much music is absorbed in your message, but you really have to have it. You mean I can't do Wind Beneath My Wings?
If you do Wind Beneath My Wings, you will have one person in your audience. It will be me smacking you.
Wait, what about, I mean, what was I going to say now? You completely knocked the question out of my mind. I really hate it when that happens. It was a very exciting question. Oh, yes, I know what it was now. I know what it was. What happens, though, when you're going to those initial Lions and Rotary clubs that you were speaking of at the beginning? Isn't it going to look a bit ostentatious if you come along with a huge sound system and PowerPoint and, you know, Rotary?
You're a performer, and that's what a speaker is. That is an element of a speaker. You have to be somewhat of a performer. You have to almost come out of your everyday character and go into your speaker character, which is very dynamic, and here's what I have to teach you today. And you have to have these other elements to go along with it. Now, when I started out in going to the Rotarians and those types of groups, I didn't go in with a big sound system and PowerPoint, but I did go in with a little CD player. I would have some intro music. I would have something. I would have a visual, or I would pass out something, or you'd have some type of a handout with a picture on it. But you have to have something that people can physically have, whether it's the sound, whether it's a handout, whether it's a slide. They need something other than your speech. But never too ostentatious.
Have you ever been to a Rotary Club speech, Jonathan? Trust me, ostentatious will save the day.
Mate, I have to confess I've given far too many of them.
Uh-huh. They do love it. They get into it. And frankly, because I do this with Wendy, and she's helped me with a lot of my visual effects and things like that. First of all, know your adaptive stuff. Secondly, get somebody to help you that you trust to do your graphics for you. If that's not something you can do by yourself, because it really does make a difference. And then be prepared to, you know, for the technology to fail. Of course, we all know about that. And, you know, be prepared, and Wendy can probably tell you some spectacular technology failures that she's had, and I know I've had a few.
Yeah, I know the truth.
That's a very important point that Janine made, is that you, even though you have to have these effects, in your presentation, you absolutely cannot rely on them to carry your presentation. Your message still has to carry the presentation with these sort of little elements coming in at the right time. But if you are relying on all of these elements to completely carry you through the presentation and you do have a technical failure, you're standing there basically looking like a complete idiot, because What do you do? If you've relied on all of these great graphics and music and everything else to take you through your hour, and it's all now completely gone wrong, or the power's off, or whatever it may be, people are still looking at you and they're expecting something to come out of your mouth. And it shouldn't be, well, what do we do now? You should continue on with your message, technical failure or not. So definitely have them in your presentation, but definitely don't rely on them.
And never, never, never swear at your computer during a speech.
Absolutely not.
Never, never, never. With that, I will let you go. Thanks, Jonathan.
That is very good advice, and I always try and apply it on the radio as well.
Exactly. Now, see, I get to give Jonathan credit here, because he gave me so much of my audio background to be able to do some of this stuff and to be able to produce some things for Wendy as well. So big thanks to you,
see,
Jonathan.
The big circle goes around again.
That's no problem. The invoice is in the mail. Hey, lovely to hear from you, Janine.
Thank you.
See you later.
Bye, Janine.
There we go. Well, we're talking about motivational speaking and the art of public speaking in general. And that's right, I think that spontaneity wins the day, doesn't it? And at least if you can wing it, then you can cope with your technology going bust in the middle of an important occasion.
You have just said the most important sentence today, is that if you are able to wing it, you are truly a professional speaker, because you have to be able to pull it out of your hat anytime, any place, and deliver it 100% with just awesome and being professional, and as you said, I mean, just be ready for anything to go wrong, and hopefully nothing will.
Yes. What sort of material do you now leave with people that you speak to?
I leave them with a basic message of the fear that we experience is always the barrier that stops us from achieving some of our greatest goals. And so I teach people how to turn fear into faith, and not necessarily a spiritual faith, but a faith that you can do it, and then the faith into action. One of my biggest messages is the only barrier between you and your goal is usually you, so get out of your way and get it done. We're very good at making excuses as to why we can't get things done. Let's start getting things done and making excuses for why we can't do 100 more things like that in the same day.
I don't know if you've read this, but I saw in the Audible catalog recently a very interesting sounding book called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway.
Yes. Have you read the book?
No, I haven't.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, interesting. Right, well, that just about wraps up our hour, and it's been flying by. I found it most interesting. And do you have any way that... you have a website that's under construction, I think.
Yes, I have a website under construction, but it does have one home page that's able to be viewed at this time.
And that website address is www.motivationdestination.com. And my email address is wendyjones@motivationdestination.com.
Okay, so motivationdestination.com is the place to go. I really appreciate you giving up your time on a Saturday afternoon, it must be still where you are, Sunday afternoon, to have a chat with us. It's been fascinating, and I wish you all the best and appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Jonathan, and thank you all viewers, I should say listeners, for listening to me for an hour.
Thanks, Wendy. Bye-bye for now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Wendy Jones, motivational speaker and quite inspirational in terms of making a career out of public speaking. So there you go. Get round those Lions and Rotary clubs. I should say, actually, that if you have a guide dog, that's always a huge advantage. People like the guide dog. At least it's like a foot-in-the-door thing. Well, we're going to move on to our open part of the program now, and if you'd like to give us a call and talk about anything, you're welcome to do that. Our number is area code 212-812-2800. That's area code 212-8-5512. That's the number to call, 0480-5512. And that should be in the title bar of most of your Windows-type players out there. Things that we can talk about this week, well, I don't know. I don't have too many blindness-related things to talk about, but I know many people who listen, many blind people in general, of course, because we're blind, I guess, rely on the radio a lot and take a lot of interest in what's going on. I read a fascinating article over the weekend about the dominance that Clear Channel is having on the American radio scene and how there are laws that now permit one entity to own up to 8 radio stations in a given market, and that this article was saying that Clear Channel's even bring in sales without actually owning the station, sort of like a contract type thing, and that some markets have heaps of stations with a Clear Channel influence, that contests are being run where they're actually national contests but they've been branded as local contests. And apparently they got into a bit of trouble with this in Florida a couple of years back, this article was saying, and since then they've had to introduce disclaimers to make it clearer that these contests are in fact national and not just local. But there were a couple of interesting comments from people who were saying, well, really, Clear Channel has taken away the spark out of radio in America. It's somehow got bland and lacks that special something that described it as. And it's exactly the same in this country. In fact, I think Clear Channel may have a bit of an influence in one of our primary radio conglomerates. You have one particular brand which is locally branded to some extent, but most of the programs are coming off a satellite and it's national, and you have these contests that appear to be local, but you're competing against a nationwide audience, and it's all pre-programmed, and it's almost like a shrink-wrapped radio package of processed cheese. And that's why independent, unpredictable, grassroots internet radio is so important. And it's so important to save. So those are just some reflections on things, you know. Clear Channel and the US radio scene. Maybe there are some blind that I'm not aware of. Obviously, other than the ongoing situation that ACB is dealing with respect to the wet macular degeneration drug and a denial of a right to appeal over a Medicare decision not to fund that, and that appeal in itself is being appealed. And the rather irresponsible comments by a Bush official somehow claiming that organizations that are objecting to this closing off of natural justice are somehow paid. Absolutely outrageous comment for a public official to make. So that's really the only blindness related story that's grabbed me over the last week, and it will be very interesting to see whether an apology is forthcoming. Well, why do you think about something to say? I was inspired to play this by Wendy's very excellent contribution to the program.
I went for a jog in the city air, I met a woman in a wheelchair, said, I'm sorry to see your handicap. She says, what makes you think a thing like that? And she looks at me real steady, and she says, you want a drag? So she starts to roll and I start to run, and she beat the pants off my aching buns. You know, going uphill I'd hit my stride, but coming down she'd sail on by. When I finally caught up with her, she says, not bad for somebody able-bodied. You know, with adequate care and supervision, you could be taught simple tasks. So how about something to eat? I said that it'd suit me fine. We're near a favorite place of mine, so we moseyed on over there. But the only way in was up a flight of stairs. Gee, I never noticed that, says I. No problem, the maitre d' replies. There's a service elevator around the back. So we made it upstairs on the elevator with the garbage, flies, and last week's potatoes. I set it like a table for my friend and me. He says, I'll try to find one out of the way. Then he whispers, is she gonna be sick? I mean, pee on the floor or throw some kind of fit? I said, no, I don't think so. I think she once had polio. That was 20 years ago. You see, the fact of the matter is, if the truth be told, she can't walk. So he points to a table, she wheels her chair. Some people look down and others stare. And a mother grabs her little girl, says, keep away, honey, that woman's ill. We felt right welcome. Then a fellow walks up and starts to babble about the devil and the Holy Bible. Says, woman's a march with flesh's sin. Pray to Jesus, you'll walk again. Then the waiter says, what can I get for you? I said, I'll have your best imported brew. And he says, what about her? I said, who? He says, her. Oh, you mean my friend here? He says, yeah. I say, what about her? Well, what does she want? Why don't you ask her? Then he apologizes. Says he never waited on a cripple before. So she talks to the manager when we're through. She says there's some things you could do to make it easier for folks in wheelchairs. He says, oh, it's not necessary. Handicapped never come here anyway. Well, I said goodnight to my newfound friend. I said, I'm beginning to understand a little bit of how it feels to roll through life on a set of wheels. She says, don't feel sorry, don't feel sad. I take the good along with the bad. I was arrested once at a protest demo, and the police had to let me go. See, we were protesting the fact that public buildings weren't wheelchair accessible. Turned out the jail was the same way. Anyway, I look at it this way. In 50 years, you'll be in worse shape than I am now. See, we're all the same, this human race. Some of us are called disabled. And the rest, well, the rest of you are just temporarily able-bodied.
Ah! Fred Small and the Talking Wheelchair Blues. I've just been listening to Merv on Interactive while it was on, and he's just saying that he has confidence that NoSoft will fix Winamp version 3. Well, we'll see if they come on main menu. We'll see if they come on main menu, won't we? Joe, good evening to you from... where are you from? Did you say...
Minneapolis,
that's it, yes. How are you?
Okay, I am a first-time caller.
Welcome to you.
Yeah, thank you, yeah. I am also a radio broadcaster who happens to be blind.
Quite right.
I say.
But, you don't work for Clear Channel, do you?
Oh, no, no. No, I don't. Boy, that would be a big conglomeration to really... Now, one interesting thing about Clear Channel, which some people don't know, one of their stations in Baltimore, which is Heaven 600, is... they're formatted soul gospel music 24 hours a day.
I think I've heard that when I was there. Yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
Interesting.
I think they're, I'm not sure, you know, stations now only, they only give their call letters at the top of the hour and so fast. But they, all of the Clear Channel stations, they went back to streaming. They stopped streaming for a while last summer, this union dispute. But now what they do is when the, like when the commercials are on their regular stations, they stream PSAs and other stuff on their website, you know, and on the, for the computer listeners, and then they will say, now we're going back to streaming.
Yes, although it'll be interesting to see how many of the music-based webcasts from them survive, because they're going to be having to pay the carp royalties as well.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's a rather... I'm also working on building my very own internet radio station and running into... and I was going to talk to you sometime anyway, but I have a lot of systems on my computer, you know, Windows 98 and... SoundForge, and I've had some computer instruction. The next thing I need to do is, from Freedom Scientific, get the tutorial tapes on the SoundForge, and be self-taught some. But I'm working with. It's actually part of my vocational plan. Would you believe it or not? To have my own internet radio station and to make it a commercial success.
Oh yeah, I think I've heard about you. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Are you working with Dennis?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah. I heard about it. Of course, preparation for that, there's always ACB Radio Interactive, where we've got a great team of blind broadcasters doing this all the time.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. I've seen the website and seen all of the questionnaires and all of the things that make it possible. Yeah. Dennis was my instructor. His time with me ran out, because you know when you're on the vocational plan. But I'm in the process of my concert now. I have to write a business plan. For a long time, I didn't have a concert, but it was still great what we had coming through Dennis Bartlett and Dave Tanner, all the equipment.
Yeah, Dennis is a good guy. I wish you luck with the business plan, because obviously now that if you're running music, of course, talk's a much easier format to run on the internet now. But with music-based internet radio, pay per song per listener. You know, if you get 1,000 listeners listening to you, that's 70 cents per song. It's not easy.
Oh, I know. Oh, that's for sure. I've written to my congressman, and I'm going to write him some other letters. Wow, this, I think it's currently House Bill, 5285, I think.
Yes, I forget the number, yeah. But it sounds like it's the kind of legislation that needs to be passed, and soon. But I was reading just the other day that both the RIAA and the webcasting industry have both appealed the ruling on the licensing. So it could go up even, since the RIAA say that it's not high enough.
Oh, heavens. Oh, ick.
Amazing, isn't it? Absolutely amazing.
Oh man, yeah, that's for sure. Because it's more of an uphill deal here. But one way or another, I'm determined to have tons of money.
Well, oh. You know, I really, you know, if you want to pursue it further, you'd be most welcome to have a look at doing a few stints on or a regular weekly show on Interactive in the interim, because I think it's a wonderful way to network with other internet broadcasters who know how it all works, and they're a great team to work with as well. We're coming up to our second birthday.
Oh yeah. Actually, I will do that as soon as I'm a little bit more familiar with SoundForge and how it works. That's I need to be more perfected in that skill, and once I've done that, I will definitely come aboard, you know, do some shows that way too. That's a good way to get to jump in the water, because I believe so much in personal radio, like what I hear in interactive, you know, instead of just we're playing five songs in a row.
That's absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I still the people that I tune into most are those who really project their personality, and you enjoy listening to them as well. It's not just their music. It's you really prick your ears up when you hear their voice breaks, because you know they're going to say something entertaining or informative.
Oh, yeah.
That's what we like.
Oh, for sure.
Hey, I really am pleased you called, and don't be a stranger, because it's great to get new callers, and I wish you luck. Give me a drop me an email if I can help in any way.
Oh, sure.
Excellent. Okay, take care.
Bye
now. Bye. Bye. There you go. That's Joe from Minneapolis. And now we have an unknown caller. Good evening.
From Minneapolis or from New York?
Oh, no, he was from Minneapolis. You're the unknown caller. I don't see an area code coming up for you, so...
Okay, 212.
Oh, how are you?
Good. When you were talking about Clear Channel, when I'm upstate on the weekends, most of the radio stations are now controlled by Clear Channel. And it's true about contests. Once I had called about something, and they were asking about my weather. It was a winter time. And whoever I was speaking to, I thought they were local, and they were in California. It was quite a surprise.
So do you call an 800 number for those, or do you okay. I mean, it doesn't seem to bother people, though, in general. This article I was reading was saying the Clear Channel stations are still rating really well. People don't seem to mind.
Well, when I'm upstate, you don't have much choice for listening. So, you know, it seems to be most of them are Clear Channel. And if I don't have my computer with me, you know, that's what I'm going to be listening to.
It makes you wonder what the future of radio actually is going to be. I wonder whether services like XM Radio are eventually just going to replace conventional radio.
It's possible. I had another issue. It's just a small, annoying issue.
Go ahead.
That I wanted to bring up. It has to do with free information calls for blind people.
Yeah.
In this country, you just register with a phone company as being blind, and you don't get charged for information calls. But it's very interesting that they claim, according to the FCC, you can only be blind in one location.
Yes.
So I have two residences, and I'm the only person that uses my phone. But as I say, it's just a personal annoying issue to me that, you know, it's not as though I'm trying to rip anybody off, but, you know, it should be a free service.
Now, can you register a cell phone for that free access as well?
I doubt it because, you know, they're claiming now, and I don't know if it's a Social Security number, but you can only access at one place. And also now in New York, the pay phones, it's 50 cents for information.
Oh, I see.
And this Yellow Pages thing doesn't work for anything like that, the free Yellow Pages. It's for business. So, you know, it's just the issue if you don't have a Braille phone book or other access. It seems like it's anti-ADA as far as I'm concerned.
I agree. And I had the situation in this country a few years ago now, about 5 years ago, when the major telecommunications company here decided that to encourage people to use the telephone book more, they were going to charge, I think it's 50 cents per call for directory assistance, and they were going to exempt home telephone numbers of blind people and people with other disabilities from that charge if you completed a form, which you had to get signed by a doctor or some sort of professional, which I found quite disempowering even then. But the problem that I pointed out to them was, well, if you are a sighted person, you can go into a telephone box and pick up a phone book, and they are marketing these little tiny cellular phone type phone directories for smaller areas that you can have in your glove compartment if you're a sighted driver. And we weren't being given the same portability of directory assistance that sighted people had. And what we did in the end was, and it's obviously not an applicable solution for the US, but our blindness agency is a nationwide organization, and they run a telephone information service with a whole lot of information on it, such as government's documents and TV program listings and all sorts of things. And you can ring it on an 800 number. And in the end, what we did was we set up a system where everybody can have a user ID and a password on the system who is blind, and they're able to access directory assistance through that. So it doesn't matter whether you're ringing on, you know, a phone at your work or wherever. If you've got this user ID and password, you can get in and get into directory assistance at no cost.
Well, they just established something like that here, the Audio Yellow Pages. But I tried to use it last week at a payphone, And apparently it's for Yellow Pages, which is business listings, not residential. And the gentleman I was speaking to was on some conference call about something else, so he couldn't help me at the moment. But he said to call the number again and get the number for a library, or call him from, or, no, what I could do is I could call my library and they could look it up for me. But I was at a payphone, I would still have to call information to get the library number for to look up the number.
Yeah.
But, so apparently this audio Yellow Pages sounded like a good idea, but as I say, when I just tried to use it the one time and it wasn't for residential and, you know, I had certain problems, so.
Now, you see, the concept of access for us is a much difficult, more difficult concept to communicate than, say, physical access for someone who uses a wheelchair.
Absolutely. And they make you feel like criminals that,
yeah.
that you're trying to get something for free that, you know, you're too lazy to look up on your own, or, you know.
Yeah, well, I presume the telephone book is something that you get as part of your phone service in the U.S., right?
Yeah, I mean, I never bought one. What am I going to do with it?
Right, but you're entitled to one. And I mean, the thing is, if
but you don't get a Braille one.
No, but what I'm getting at is, if you're entitled to one, then you should also be entitled to access wherever you are. I mean, if you've obviously you're entitled to a phone book at both of your residences, so you should be entitled to access at both of your residences. It's as simple as that.
I'm in total agreement, and I really cannot believe that New York says that the FCC says that I can only get it at one place.
Well, you know, it might even be worth writing to the FCC and verifying that that is the case.
I spoke with the New York State, the woman who heads the Public Service Commission for New York State, and she told me to get in touch with a phone company, and they were just totally unresponsive, so that was as far as I got. She couldn't believe it herself, but obviously nothing's still been done about it.
Yeah. Oh, well, hey, do keep us posted and fight the good fight on this, because it's just a question of equity and access. And sometimes,
I mean, you sound like, I mean, I feel like I'm nickel and diming, but
no, it's the principle
know,
of the thing.
At the payphone, and if it's long distance information, it's a couple of bucks a pop.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think it's free on your phone bill, and if you have somebody go over your phone bill really carefully, very often these things are slipped in, and they'll say, well, we didn't know. And I'll say, well, the address on my bill has this D after my name, which I think indicates disabled. But even if you're listed that way, they're still snuck in.
Hey, you know, hang in there. And if you make some progress, do let us know, because I'm intrigued as to how you get on.
Great.
All the best.
Thank you.
Okay,
bye-bye
now. What do you think of that, folks? Give us a call and let me know what your thoughts are on that. Hi, this is Blindline.
Well, good afternoon, Jonathan. This is Stan Luttrell.
How are you, Stan? Are you using a new long-distance provider?
Well, actually, what I'm doing is I'm using a calling card so that I use it before the company decides that it doesn't want to, you know, honor the service. So I want to use it while it's still good.
What, is it with WorldCom or what?
Yes. Yes, it is. I was not going to say the name of the company, but yes, it's because I've heard that sometimes when you have those calling cards like that, it's those cards that are eliminated first, even if you prepaid them.
Oh, man. Oh, well, I'm glad you're here.
That would be a good thing.
It's not a $3.2 billion calling card, is it?
No. In their eyes it might be, but certainly not in mine.
Hmm.
Of course, you never know. By the time they add the figures up, it might be 3.2 today and 6 billion tomorrow.
It might be, yeah.
One of the things that's interesting, and it's one thing I'm experiencing that I think, I don't know, I know you have a cell phone, but one of the things that would be neat to have on them, maybe some brands do, is a battery low beeper, so that if you're blind, you know when the battery's low.
Well, the cell phone I have has that, but the trouble is, it beeps when it's going low. I think just about every cell phone I've ever had has done that, and I've owned too many of them. But what I haven't had is a battery level indicator that tells me how many bars are on the battery meter. And that should be quite a simple thing. For example, on the current phone I have, I think the if the battery's full, you've got four bars that come up on the display. You could just you could just have it beeping four times to tell you what the level is, but they don't.
That's the kind of thing I mean. I think it should. I think it should be. It would seem like an easy thing to do for to establish when you know you have a full battery.
Yeah.
It's really strange because sometimes things can happen, and you know, the batteries can get low real quick when you're not planning on it.
Well, I think that, you know, I'm about to reach the stage in my life where I should have a midlife crisis. I think it's about time for this, and if I do that, one of the things I'd like to do is take a sabbatical, you know, for about 6 months or 7 months and really learn how to program, because I have all these good ideas about things like that, and I can't program to save myself to actually implement them. So when I have my midlife crisis, I will decide that I need to do more with my life and change direction and take up computer programming.
But, you know, it's very interesting because if you ask the people, are phones accessible, they look at you, what do you mean?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's getting the concept across. But it's what I was saying to the previous caller. Our concepts of access are so much more difficult to convey.
Yes, they are. And to make sure that people understand what you're talking about. And of course, it's hard to believe how small, I mean, you know, these cell phones are, and how close the buttons can be on some of these phones.
Do you listen to Main Menu?
Yes.
Okay, well, have a listen on this week's show, where we're going to be talking in the news brief section about how they are developing a fiber that will go in clothing that will enable a cell phone to be built right into a shirt. It will be weaved into the clothing, into the fabric.
Oh, that's a scary thought.
Yeah.
It's my like T-shirt's ringing. Where, I don't remember if you remember several years ago, there was some talk about wearable computers.
Well, with this kind of fiber, they're hoping that that will be a reality, that it'll all be weaved into your clothing, and that because of this technology, a shirt, for example, or a sweater, a jersey, would be able to adjust itself to the temperature that's appropriate for where you are.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Especially if you're, of course, if you're in one of these cold climates now here in Medford, Oregon. Recently, we've had all sorts of problems with the fires. And, of course, it's been very warm, you know, fairly warm here in the 90s and 100s. And the only thing is, now all we need to do is have it adjust for how to get rid of the smell of smoke.
Well, I was reading another, that's right, they need to do that. I was reading another article last week that was a bit too complex for me to, because it's working on a device that uses speech recognition to, how does it work? See, this is very difficult to explain. Okay, say that you're at a party or somewhere like that. Or you're in someone's office. Yeah, okay, you're in someone's office, and you meet someone, and this little device takes a kind of snapshot of their voice. When you get out of the office, you write in on this device what the name of the person is, and you keep doing this meticulously. Whenever you meet someone in a good situation like that, you write down their name into this thing. And then, when you're at a cocktail party, you can start walking around, and there's a little microphone on your head that's supposed to be reasonably discreet, and when it picks up somebody that it knows, it will tell you who this is. Ideal for a blind. How often?
Definitely.
How often is it that you have some idiot saying, "Guess who this is?" You know.
Oh yes. Oh yes, and I'm probably going to experience that even more in about, well, about a month, because I'm going to my high school reunion in California.
Oh. Is that a mainstream high school?
Oh, yes.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, yes. And so what will happen is I know I'll see, or hear, whatever you want to say, a bunch of people I haven't talked to in years, and they will assume I know who they are. And sometimes, you know, the character of voices change over the
years.
So they don't sound like they did.
Especially the guys.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, 30 years ago. And so you go through this kind of thing where people are assuming, and all of a sudden you feel like, and yet you put all these things on yourself, expectations on yourself, when you shouldn't have them, but you expect yourself to always remember sometimes.
I think those reunions are dreadfully embarrassing. You meet up with people, but they're also fascinating because some of the people that you'd picked in your head would turn out to be majorly academically or business successes. They haven't gone where you thought they'd go.
Or vice versa.
Or Vicky. Yes, that's right. You can have somebody who you thought was an absolute no-hoper who's now a billionaire or something.
Yeah, I mean, those are the kind of things that'll be interesting to picture, you know, what happens. And, of course, one thing you don't know as a blind person or how many people, you know, let's say you're, you know, you may have a full set, you know, full head of hair, you know, and how many people are ending up all their gray hair or whatever.
And I'll tell you the other problem about those reunions, when you're going to a reunion of a mainstream high school, is that because you're a blind guy, you stand out from the crowd. Everybody knows who you are. They all remember you. And half of these people who come up and talk to you, you probably wouldn't have even spoken to at school, but they remember you vividly because you were a blind guy.
Exactly. And I had this happen once before because I never went to the reunions until, you know, the 15th, well, sometimes I didn't find out about until the 25th year reunion. And that is the first thing I noticed when I went to the 25th reunion was that you had these people that would come up and, you know, would hardly have the time of day when you were in school. And yet it wasn't because they didn't, you know, a lot of times it's just because you get so busy and you're just going, you know, chemistry, physics, this and that and the other thing, so you don't... You don't always have the time, or at least, you know, in class or whatever. But, yeah, I've noticed that.
Now, they're always the good sides, though. I mean, what about when you get into a situation where that girl at high school that you were absolutely besotted with and you couldn't pluck up the courage to talk to is there and all very interested?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, that happens. Too.
Not that ever happens to me, of course, but that's all right.
Well, I have a feeling...
Don't need it to.
I have a feeling you were, shall we say, a stuff disturber when you were in school.
Well, however did you get that impression?
I just have a feeling.
I look at my school reports, and I think it's clear to me that they decided I was a write-off, you know, and they were right.
But it's kind of interesting, and of course, getting away from the school thing, I'm having, you know, I've listened to your tutorial, I've done all sorts of stuff with SoundForge, and I'm working on, I've gotten even Brian Hartchin's new sets for WindowEyes for the SoundForge 6.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm probably going to have to uninstall some things because the sets, for some reason, would not... They're showing themselves to be there, but they're not installing.
Hmm. Have you spoken to Brian about that?
I've emailed him, and he said for me to check on certain things, which I'm kind of thinking, because I'm using WinZip to unzip the files. And recently I was using an evaluation version of WinZip that I never bothered to register.
One thing you do have to be careful of, too, is that with the newer versions of WindowEyes, you don't unzip set files into the /WinEyes directory anymore.
No, it's the user default.
Yeah.
Isn't it the CWinEyes user default, I think it is.
Yes, I think that's it. And, you know, I have to break the habit of a lifetime.
And that is, you know, sort of weird, too, because you have to really remember to get used to doing that. And you have this kind of thing where, you know, you just... Because you can use the, you know, unregistered versions of WinZip, but, you know, it's just an evaluation. So what I did do is I, you know, spent the money and, you know, registered and made it permanent.
Yay.
So at least I've gotten the WinZip.
I like WinZip a lot. WinZip is a great program. It's a very good investment. I bought WinZip back when it was version I don't know, five something, and I haven't paid a cent for it since, and it's a great program. Even though Windows XP does have zip support built in, I still load my WinZip on there.
Because I have 8.0, even though I'm in 8.1 is out now, but I just, you know, had 8.0 and just registered and, you know, purchased, you know, for one thing, you get rid of that stupid screen at the beginning. But, you know, it's just some very weird stuff that happens with, you know, like with the set files occasionally, and I know Brian's done a lot of work on them, and he and I have emailed back and forth about this thing, and he's probably thinking, what in the world is this person doing? But it's just, every computer has a glitch somewhere.
What? So when you do your control backslash to get into WindowEyes when SoundForge is running, what set file does it say is loaded and associated?
It shows, you know, for the previous versions, 5.0.
Oh.
For the sets for that, but it doesn't show for 6.0.
Wow, how interesting. There must be some very logical explanation for it.
So what I'm thinking about doing is just going and uninstalling the whole thing and even, you know, going through, because sometimes I think SoundForge is even rather tricky to install.
Okay.
You know, maybe I'm doing something wrong, but I think, you know, what I might do is just uninstall it and reinstall and see if there's a problem there.
Well, I wish you luck.
Yeah, so it's going to be very interesting, and I'll let you get back to what you're doing and talk to you some other time.
Okay, now when's this reunion?
It is September the... Let's see here. The 15th.
Okay, well, I'll look forward to a blow-by-blow account when you get home.
Oh, the things that I can talk about, who knows? Maybe I'll talk about things I should talk. Well, you never know. I'll
beautiful.
Talk to you then, though.
Well, let's get off here before we bankrupt WorldCom.
Yeah, right.
All right. Goodbye. That was Stan calling on WorldCom. So it still works. This is Blind Line, and we still have a few minutes to go. If you'd like to give us a call, the board is free. The number is area code 212-812-2800. That's area code 212-812-2800. And the conference code, thanks to Spiderphone, is 0480-5512. That's 0480-5512. Tell you something interesting that we've just discovered in this country that is absolutely remarkable, is that the government agency that helps people with disabilities to get into employment is unable to provide job support funding for blind people who work for the blindness agency, because under the definition that they've been given by the government, a blind person, even if they sought a job at the blindness agency, you know, that's management related or rehabilitation related, in other words, they're a qualified professional who just happens to be blind and happens to want to help their fellow blind person by working for the blindness agency, well, apparently they can't get any assistance with, for example, funding for a driver to do the job or a reader, because under the definition, the blindness agency isn't considered integrated employment. And the reason for that is because the number of blind people the blindness agency employs is too high. I mean, we're not talking about sheltered employment, which is a different argument again. We are talking about, although I still think the outcome would be equally outrageous, but nevertheless, we're talking about people who happen to be blind, and obviously the agency for the blind saying, well, of course, if we can't employ good quality blind people, why? How could we expect the rest of the world to? So these people are managers, they're rehabilitation workers, they've got the appropriate qualifications, they might be involved in technology instruction, you name it. I mean, one of the very senior managers in the organization is a blind person with an MBA. But they're because they work for the blindness agency, doesn't fit with the definition of integrated setting. Absolutely amazing. You might also want to talk about the whole question of directory assistance. Now, here's Hersher, Illinois. What a lovely place. I've never been there, but I'm sure it is. Hello there.
Hello, Jonathan. This is Tunehead.
I thought it was you looking at the area code. How are you?
Oh, doing just fine, man. This is the first time I think I've ever called in here before.
It is, so I'm deeply, deeply honored.
Oh, hey, thanks, Sue. I wanted to ask you what your impressions are of Winamp 3, since you mentioned it earlier.
Well, I should probably get off the radio before I answer that question. No, sure. it's the pits.
It is, man, I tell you. Because I downloaded it yesterday and couldn't do a dang thing with it.
Well, you can't, I mean, that's not, you can open files. I can open files, you know, all the keyboard commands are there, and using the NQ and Winamp, I can build a playlist, but where I get stuck is going into the preferences. That doesn't seem to work, and obviously the menu bar's gone, so you can't even bring down that handy little menu anymore.
Right.
So we,
the scripts are broken, man, because you can't even do anything.
Because it's a completely different program, of course. It's been rewritten absolutely from the ground up. I don't think there's one single bit of code in there that's the same. So we are in touch with Nullsoft and seeking to get somebody on main menu as soon as we can.
Oh, cool, because that's what I was going to ask you about. I heard you mention that earlier, because people are all over it on the Winamp for the Blind list. Not that I was going to plug that or anything.
No, no, of course not.
But people were asking me, because I think that some of the newer people on the list think that I am somehow in contact with Nullsoft, because I have actually written to them, and I said, hey, look, you know, I'm a big fan of Winamp, and I've got this list, and you do have people that really do, you know, in some ways rely on Winamp to be accessible, and I think that some of the newer people hear about that, and they're like, well, you know, this guy obviously knows them, and I'm just a user, you know, I'm just a guy who happens to love it, and all that, so I'm very pleased you're going to have somebody on there, or at least going to try to have
Well, we've invited them, and we're working through those issues. I have been in touch with Nullsoft through, occasionally through this beta cycle, and it's been a very long development cycle, and at one stage I was in touch with them before the keyboard commands were implemented, and I did get an assurance from them that the keyboard commands would be there, and they are. But obviously what they've overlooked, either deliberately or accidentally, is that there's more to accessibility than keyboard commands.
Oh yeah.
And when you get into the preferences, the controls just don't seem to be navigable at all. And
they took you quite literally almost when they said keyboard commands, because I mean, you've got the B and you've got the Z.
Oh yeah,
and all that, so.
Yes.
Maybe they took you literally on that one. I don't know, man. But anyways, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I did want to call in and say hey, and hope you guys are doing well. And
well, that's right. It's a pretty slow day today, so that's not a problem. I would just add that the new architecture, the Wasabi architecture, does mean, as I understand it, that it would be possible for a talented developer to write a version of Winamp 3 that's even more accessible than what we currently have in version 2.8.
Because,
so all the tools are there to make a very accessible player. I just don't know who would be doing that.
Yeah, and they've got this thing called the Thinger, I guess.
The Thinger.
You heard about this?
Yeah, I heard about the Thinger, yeah.
I don't know, it's some kind of a toolbar or something?
Yes, but I don't...
I'm not sure.
Can you get
I'm
to it from the keyboard, though?
Not that I can see, because I looked for it, and I even tried it with Windows 4.2, and it wasn't even working with that. And some guy on the list had been saying it was the PC audio list, but he said that he couldn't even, he got it to work fine, and I'm like, dude, you must be some kind of cool set file writer, because I couldn't get it to work with either one, with JAWS 4.5 or Windows 4.2, so I don't know what the deal is. But, and also, now, when I shut Winamp 3 down, it gives me this, It says studio dialogue, and it gives me the program is performing illegal operation.
Yeah, I have seen that, but I installed it. Did you say that you didn't want it to handle your default file types?
I think I actually did, but then I had to go back and I changed it because I thought, well, wait a second, I don't want to, you know, take over it, because if it doesn't work...
That's right.
Then, yeah, because then I had to change everything back to 2.8.0, which I have right now. So,
I think when you do that, that's what causes that illegal operation.
Oh, well,
from what I've been able to tell.
Well, I'm gonna uninstall it, because it's obviously not gonna be very useful to me now. So, but I just wanted to see your impressions of it, because I actually credit you with me using Winamp and starting the list, because without your help and your very expertise on the whole thing, I don't think I would have been able to even get this whole thing.
Well, that's very nice. You know, I was using Winamp in 1996 or 7 when it came out, and people in those days used to say how inaccessible it was, and it wasn't inaccessible at all. It was just a bit unconventional. But,
yeah.
Man, I would have to say, unless I'm missing something really fundamental, version 3 is what I would call inaccessible. It's very dodgy.
It is very dodgy, and that's the first word that came to my mind, in fact, and I could probably say something that I couldn't even say on the air. But anyways, man, well, I'll let you go, but I wanted to call in and say hello, I think, for the first time on this show anyways. But just wanted to call in and say, hey, man, so I'll call you later, talk to you later, man, okay?
Okay, have a good night.
Okay, you
okay.
Too, man.
Bye now.
Bye.
That's Chris Carstadt, who is as frustrated as many of us are over Winamp, and we will have to see if we can get someone from Nullsoft on. We are planning a very exciting series of birthday celebrations, including hopefully a new contest that we'll be able to tell you about for ACB Radio Interactive. ACB Radio Interactive is 2 years old on September the 2nd, and we will be having lots of fun. Now, there is a way in which you can contribute to that fun, and we would really appreciate it if you did that. You can send us a birthday message just wishing us happy birthday. And we're going to provide lots of ways to do that. But one way that's already active is if you can record an MP3 file and email it to acbri@acbradio.org. That stands for ACB Radio Interactive, you see. acbri@acbradio.org. And we will be playing your birthday greetings throughout the weekend, or throughout the birthday celebrations, which begin on Monday, the 2nd of September, on ACB Radio Interactive. So we're going to have some great times, and it's looking like great giveaways as well. So we'll tell you more about that as we get closer to the time. In the meantime, the board is free, and if you'd like to give us a call and perhaps finish the program off on a high note, it's area code 212-812-2800. That's area code 212-812-2800, and the conference code is 0480-5512, thanks to spiderphone.com, 0480-5512. And tomorrow we have Monday night, or I guess it's Tuesday, Universal Time, talk with John Wiedlich. Wiedlich. And he will be speaking with the president of the Missouri Council of the Blind. And if there are other affiliate presidents who'd like to call in, that'd be good as well. So join John for his guest tomorrow, and you can also call in and contribute. And after John, of course, Phil Parr and friends are along with the Blind Handyman Show. Wow, that's an interesting program, isn't it? Do those things you never thought you could, thanks to the assistance of the Blind Handyman Show. So that's coming on at around about 2 Universal Time. That's 10 Eastern and 7 Pacific. Did I say 7? Yes, I did, and I was right for once. On ACB Radio Mainstream. So we'll look forward to hearing that as well. Well, it's just about time, I think, for us to be off, I guess, if we're not going to hear any more stimulating contributions from you. And we'll be back. I'll be back with just operating for John tomorrow, and then we'll have main menu on Wednesday. So we'll look forward to your company then. So I've got time for a piece of music before we wrap up. Oh, let's try this one. This is Napoleon the 14th. Thanks for calling Blind Line. We'll see you next week. Nanu nanu.
Remember when you ran away and I got on my knees and begged you not to leave because I go berserk? Well, you left me anyhow, and then the days got worse and worse, and now you see I've gone completely out of my mind. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha, they're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha, to the funny farm where life is beautiful all the time, and I'll be happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats, and they're coming to take me away, ha-ha! You thought it was a joke, and so you laughed. You laughed when I had said that losing you would make me flip my lid. Right? You know you laughed. I heard you laugh. You laughed, you laughed, and laughed, and then you left. But now you know I'm utterly mad. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha. They're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha. To the happy home with trees and flowers and chirping birds and basket weavers.
who sit and smile and twiddle their thumbs and toes and their cutting to take me away.
I cooked your food, I cleaned your house, and this is how you pay me back for all my kind, unselfish, loving deeds. Well, you just wait, they'll find you yet, and when they do, they'll put you in the ASPCA, you mangy mutt. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha, they're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha, to the funny farm where life is beautiful all the time, and I'll be happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats, and they're coming to take me away.